A year ago, the CEO of Perplexity came out and he said the first two industries that are going to be disrupted are recruiting and executive assistant. And what he said was that within the next 6 months, all recruiters will be replaced. So what did I do? I went to Perplexity's hiring page and searched recruiters, and they had 6 open roles for recruiters. So the CEO that's in the marketplace saying recruiters are going to be replaced within the next 6 months is hiring 6 recruiters for his firm. So it's just a lot of noise out there right now.
Welcome to the How Leaders Think podcast, the show that transforms you by renewing your mind and giving you new ways to think. I am your host, Kenny Lang, and with me today is the Ryan Hogan. He is the founder and CEO of Talent Harbor. He is a serial entrepreneur, not like the Frosted Flakes kind. He is co-founder and CEO of Hunt a Killer. He acquired that in January of 2024, and it's number 6 on the Inc. 5000. That's really high. 23 years in the United States Navy. Thank you, sir. Vistage member since 2017. Awesome sauce. I'm a certified speaker, so I love that community. EO member since 2025. New kid on the block. And host of Confessions of an EOS Implementer podcast, which should be like really, really intriguing because these people get to see the inside of some messed up situations because they're there trying to help. His expertise covers scaling companies, leadership development, strategic growth, and of course, EOS or the entrepreneurial operating system. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Kenny. Appreciate it.
This is going to be a lot of fun. I wish we actually did have those dirty martinis that we could just sip. This would become a really interesting podcast if we had those to go along with our combo. But I feel like that's a different podcast. We might need to spin off.
Could.
We could do martinis that. And Mindshare or something. I don't know. The pieces are there.
I'll see if the domain's available as soon as we hang up.
Fantastic. Look at this. This is how partnerships start. Yeah. But tell me today, Ryan, what is on your mind?
Yeah, I think this is constantly on my mind is business models. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about quite frequently over the last several weeks, maybe several months, but the hardest thing to do in entrepreneurship is find product market fit. And for me, like I would say that's my subject matter expertise. That's my magic sauce. Okay. I'm not necessarily the 1 to 10 guy. I'm more of like the fool's sprint to find product market fit. And the big thing that I'm thinking about right now is how do we fix our model? Because while we at Talent Harbor have found product market fit as far as like we have a service and we're able to sell it, it's broken. And so that's what's been top of mind for me is like true product market fit for me is some sort of predictability, recurring revenue. And so that's what I've been tinkering with.
You know what's funny is I was on a call this morning just before this for probably about an hour and a half, and a big part of our conversation, and this is something in the works, but it was about product market fit. And even for myself with Kenny Lang Coaching and having a background in marketing and sales, that's been a tough thing to think about to figure out. Especially when you're like, I could do anything. And even as an EOS implementer, you could say, I mean, there's a wide berth of companies that technically could benefit from it, but it's not for everybody and not every system's for everyone and every business. So what are you, when you think about this and you're with clients or just out for a walk, whatever you're observing, what's the prevailing wisdom around product market fit? Because I have to imagine it's not leading to everybody becoming billionaires.
That's true. And to a certain extent, I feel like anybody can, like if you're driving your ambition and your goal is to become a billionaire, I believe that is possible. Like it's for me, it's about like the sacrifice and product market fit. The definition of product market fit is different for everybody. So the way that I see product market fit, like one of the ways that I just defined it to you is the aspect of recurring revenue, which has a certain amount of predictability inside of the business model. What I see, I've only been in business services now for 2 years. And so this is my first run. I'm in the recruiting industry. I've partnered with an amazing recruiter. So I'm kind of like the face of the company, if that's a thing, or the visionary in terms of EOS. Right. And she is very much the integrator and the subject matter expertise, 25 years of recruiting. But the way that I define product market fit is that recurring revenue aspect. And so coming into the business service, what I see all too often is people are trading time for money. And you will never become a billionaire trading time for money. And so the whole thing there is you have to figure out a way to productize your offering. That's my philosophy. And so that's what we did in the recruiting space. And now we're like, we have found the vein. We've got this incredible market and we're doing incredible work for that market. But what we're missing right now is that recurring revenue. And that means like we've got some things to tinker with. So
yeah,
long-winded, but that's top of mind.
No, and by the, that's my favorite type of wind. And that feels like a weird t-shirt I should make later. But the notion of having a different definition, I think is helpful and healthy, especially by industry. But you've defined it with recurring revenue, and I may even want to get you to break down how you're thinking about recurring versus reoccurring, because I think those can be very different, especially in the services space. But a lot of this has been taken from the world of software and SaaS, software as a service. Is instead of paying $1,000 for Adobe Photoshop suite, you pay $50 or $75 a month and you get all the programs. But as soon as you turn off that faucet, no more creative water. So with the way things are shifting with AI, and I don't mean that to sound as vague as it did, but I definitely see that the business models are going to have to shift, because what's possible, what's needed, I think is changing dramatically in the landscape. There are already some job disruptions, and primarily that's happening for guys and gals like you and me that are in more of what you would consider white collar work. So how does product market fit and recurring revenue or reoccurring revenue, how does that fit in given where we're headed over the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, my whole thing with AI and technology, and let's just take it back to software. So my last company was called Hunt a Killer, and we scaled very rapidly, and our primary sales channel was direct to consumer. So we spent a lot of money, I guess you could call it invest, but I would say spent a lot of money in Facebook advertising. Okay. And 10 years ago, 15 years ago, what was constantly happening was all these software SaaS companies coming and saying, oh, we've got this new tool, this new feature, this new thing. Mm-hmm. And it almost became a distraction, because instead of really understanding what we needed as an organization or what we were trying to accomplish or facilitate via technology, we were looking at the technologies in the feature set and trying to figure out how to back that in to make us more efficient. And I really don't think it's any different with AI. I think there's a lot of distraction right now in the marketplace as far as AI this, AI that. You have to do it this way. And the reality is, I think what businesses need to do immediately is sit down and think through what do they actually need. And when you think about the efficiencies that you can gain. So when you think about booking calls or sending emails, like I look at AI as an exoskeleton where it can give us superpowers.
Right.
As far as replacing, at least in our industry, I think it can make our recruiters more efficient and effective in the work that they do. And what does efficiency mean? Like for us, it doesn't mean downsizing because we're growing. And so if anything, it just means maybe hiring a little bit slower because a lot of those
right.
menial tasks that is not worth the recruiter's time. So again, booking calls and things like that yeah. can be automated. So I think like the way companies need to think over the next 12 to 18 months is really sit down and say, what do we need? How can we become more efficient? And really try their best to block out the noise, because there's a lot of noise right now in the marketplace. And my argument with that is all of these AI CEOs right now are using the public domain to pitch their investors. And I think there's a lot of hype and it's causing a lot of distraction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. I think we've had more noise than the signal to noise ratio is probably the most off it's ever been.
Yeah.
Which makes things like finding product market fit and gathering, not data, because data at this point, in my opinion, is easy to get. It's getting intelligence from that data that's usable. I want to go back to something you were saying about sitting down and thinking about what does our company need? What do our clients really want? it sounds like you would advocate for setting any technology, whether recent, past, or AI driven and newer, set all of that to the side and just think about the human element of pain, need, solving, and solution. Am I hearing you correctly on that, or I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I think that's the first and foremost. It's got to start with the client or the customer. And I've got several examples. Like we were talking about some of the noise in the market space. There's a lot of different directions to take this, but it starts with the customer and what pain point are you solving for them? So for us, like where our clients see the value is that they're getting incredible candidates in their pipeline. So what we're doing is we're sending over a fully vetted candidate every single week. And what we're doing is we're saving them the frustration of putting together the materials to be able to convince whoever that person is that the opportunity they have is better than the one that they're currently in. We're doing all the sourcing, we're doing all the outreach, and then we're doing all the vetting. And when you think about the actual recruiting process, what we're doing is not just saving them time, but also we have access to people, humans, databases, things like that, that kind of take it to the next level. And that's the pain point that we're solving is we're the matchmakers in the professional universe. And that doesn't mean that like this new AI thing or all this noise that's in the marketplace is necessarily worth paying attention to. And just one anecdote on that. A year ago, the CEO of Perplexity came out and he said, the first two industries that are going to be disrupted are recruiting and executive assistant. And what he said was that within the next 6 months, all recruiters will be replaced. So what did I do? I went to Perplexity's hiring page and searched recruiters, and they had six open roles for recruiters. So the CEO that's in the marketplace saying recruiters are going to be replaced within the next 6 months is hiring six recruiters for his firm. So it's just a lot of noise out there right now.
I think what is becoming more clear to me and what you're saying is really when we think about product market fit and recurring revenue and those things, we need to be thinking about first about doing the right thing. And then we can think about doing it right. And that's where the efficiencies, like you said, like we might go a little longer before we need to hire. It's not that we won't. We just have a longer runway because our current recruiters can now handle a higher capacity load of responsibilities. When people hear words like, and I use this too, your expertise in your bio lists, scaling companies. And I love that. I have my lead to scale model. I have a weekly email called Scale Weekly. And I think when people think scale, it may just be like a runaway roller coaster. But when we start thinking about AI or doing the right things or doing things right, it seems to me it's often more about gaining those efficiencies as opposed to you might become more effective, but it's maybe by virtue of that being spread or finding more places that you fit. Or is it about not diluting, because that sounds like a negative word, but it might be expanding your audience to be broader, which can either be a big help or the death of you, I think. Yeah. How does that, as you start to scale, how does product market fit change and evolve for a company so that they don't become so rigid that they're inflexible or so flexible that no one knows what the hell they stand for anymore?
Yeah. And like specifically with the product, I think there always needs to be flexibility. And that's my argument in product market fit. And I don't have all the great ideas and I'm not brilliant. I just understand that speed and the open-mindedness to let the market tell you where to take your product or your service is the key. Like that's the fastest way to get there is full sprint. You have a hypothesis because everything before it hits the market is a hypothesis. It's a best guess at what a business leader or an entrepreneur or somebody thinks is going to work. You have no idea if it's going to work or not until you take it to market. And the whole idea there is open-minded to let the market signals tell you how to evolve the product. And my position here, like when you talk about not becoming too rigid and like how to scale effectively is it's a constant evolution. So for instance, like we've evolved our business model probably seven times over the last 2 years. that might be a little bit on the extreme side. That's also startup mode. So it's, I don't think Adobe's out there looking at their business model and changing the whole thing seven times every 24 months. So yeah. there is a based upon like your stage and size, how often that you need to do this, but it's constant flexibility. It's constantly looking at the market, listening to the signals, and it's always a best guess. Mm-hmm. And it's just being unafraid to fail. And that's really it, because every failure, you're going to get a data point, and then you can continue to iterate from there. That can also lead you into a whole nother trap, which is you're listening to every market signal and you're changing it based upon one or two. So it's a double-edged sword. You got to be careful, but yeah, you just be unafraid.
I like the phrase, you win or you learn.
Yep.
Either it's a smashing success or you got a data point, which is, it can be really hard, especially for founders and entrepreneurs, because so much of our identity gets wrapped up in our business. We are our business. So if anything in the business failed, we failed. And by extension, we're now failures and we should hang our heads low. It's hard to separate yourself from that. I had a question and hopefully it comes back to me, but I think I'm curious on your perspective of product market fit. Does that differ from service market fit, right? Because a product is a product, right? You can purchase it. It's probably has a nice little graphic with it, or you can hold and touch it. But things that are truly services, like what you and I provide, that can feel a little different, especially early on, because you are the provider of the service. It's not external to you. So if you're changing the product, you essentially feel like you might be changing yourself. Can you talk to that a little bit and the differences there?
Yeah, I probably have a ton of bias here, meaning that like my past experiences, like I come out of consumer product, or not just consumer product. I guess there was a consumer service because I had a zombie infested 5K obstacle course race, but I came out of the consumer space. So a lot of this stuff is going to be, there's a lot of bias and experience that comes from there that I'm trying to transition in. And so like the nuance is product market fit, service market fit. The reason that I would differentiate this is because I believe very strongly that services should be productized. Because I think without productizing services, generally speaking, you're trading time for money. And if you're trading time for money, like nothing's wrong with that. So if someone wants to go and be incredibly successful and earn a few million each year, like that's amazing. That's not my goal. And so like when I'm thinking about product market fit, I'm thinking about how do I productize services in a way where it can be bundled. And it's not about hiding. It's about there's a certain value for the services. What is that outcome? And the minute that you start separating this whole notion of this is how much it is on an hourly basis, and you start saying these are the outcomes I'm providing and this is the value associated with those outcomes, and if that the value of those outcomes is greater than the cost of your product, then you're going to get some sort of transaction at the end of that. So I think again there's a lot of nuance in here and service market fit, and I'm sure we could have a debate, or maybe the audience is having their own debates and they're like, this guy's full of crap. But it's just the way that I think about it, which is if you want to scale a company, then you have to productize whatever it is. It doesn't matter whether you're right in the consumer space or the business service space.
It has to be easily repeatable and not beholden to any one person or piece. It's transferable and portable, right? Yep. Which is, I think, one reason why so many people do AI is especially with the move towards a more agentic platform or AI agents, where you can program it and it can do the same thing over and over at the same, pretty much the same exact level. Whereas humans, we have variants, like we get tired, we have emotions, whereas AI doesn't, at least not yet. And, or in my case, the last week or so, like everything in my world has been covered in yellow and green pollen everywhere. And I have pretty severe allergies. So there's some days I'm supposed to be on a call and I'm like, I can't breathe. I'm tired. AI would never suffer from that. Right. And so humans are the bottleneck there. And I think a lot of scaling is largely what's the most prominent bottleneck? How do we fix that? And then we move on to the next one, right? Until we just get the throughput to be maximized all the way through. If in thinking about productizing services, one thing I know I've dealt with this too is how do you make it feel Like, I got something that really was made for me in a service, because even if you productize it, there's still a relational aspect, whether that's between you and your account manager or directly, like in your case, a recruiter that they're working for with. In my case, I'm a coach. It's one thing for me to say, hey, yeah, you need executive coaching and you should talk to my AI about it, versus, no, you're going to sit down with me. I'm going to listen to you. We're going to interact. Even if the advice is the same, it's going to feel different coming from me. You can feel boxed in as a service provider by productizing and naming it, because it's like your go-to answer is always, it depends. Yeah. Could you help me with this? It depends. Could you do this? It depends. I'm yeah. capable of many of these things, and some of the variables are on your side of the table and I can't control those. So it depends. How have you worked in your business and with your clients to get away from feeling so boxed in by that? And have you struggled with that, given your range of experience and what you're capable of?
Yeah. And like in the world that we live in today and AI and the digital universe, I think humans feel probably more disconnected than ever. I think that's why Hunt a Killer was so successful. Hunt a Killer was an analog game in an era where everybody's pulling out apps and playing video games and everything else. Like, we literally shipped physical items to doorsteps every single month. Our detectives, as we called them, would open the box and they would work their way through this immersive investigation. I think people crave, we're humans. Like, we crave connection. It's mm-hmm. almost like why we exist. And so I don't think that the relationship aspect of this will ever go away. And like the it depends thing, like there's so many variables beyond as service providers, beyond our control. I'll give you an example in the recruiting space, which is we can only be successful if we can convince our clients to make sure that they are positioning themselves correctly. And here's a few examples of that. Number one, like, what is the opportunity? And making sure that the people that we're going after are going to value that opportunity greater than the one that they have today. Making sure that they have the right culture in place. And so we work with a ton of companies that are operating on EOS. They're some of the best companies out there because they already have their VTO, the Vision Traction Organizer. They already have their core values. Like, everything is already set. And so that works as well. They understand who they are, why they exist, where they're going. And this all helps in the sale process, because that's what recruiting is. And that's why I believe like recruiting is a very relational business. Mm-hmm. Has AI impacted it? Of course. My son applied to Chipotle 2 weeks ago and the whole thing was AI. Like, he had an AI interview and had to, it was crazy. But that's...
Will you charge for extra guac?
Yes.
Yes, of course I will. Three times as much. You're hired.
That's it. And so is there disruptions? Yes. But to get the type of talent and the caliber of talent, like, there has to be a human connection there. Another example of this is salary range. Sometimes when we are not successful with clients, and we're open and transparent, and the market tells you, like, people do comp studies all day long. But comp studies are still hypothesis, meaning like when you do the research, and you understand what everybody's making, you now have data and you have a hypothesis, but the market will tell you. So if we go to market and every time we get to the salary range, we get hung up one, not necessarily hung up, that's where the conversation stops. The market has told us that there's a discrepancy between what the target offering is and where the market's at. And those are things that are beyond our control, but this is where the human aspect comes in. I think this is to your point of like, you have to build that relationship. So the only way that we're able to have the candid conversations of, hey, this is what the market's saying. Hey, mm-hmm. these are your core values. You may not have them written down yet, but based upon our observation, these are kind of the things that we're sensing and feeling. You can only have those types of conversations if there's an existing relationship.
That very, very well said. So then where does that leave us in terms of, let's focus in on leaders, probably more at the executive or the founder type. What's ahead for them in understanding the market still values human relationships, but this technology is here that could gain us efficiencies at a scale and a pace that we haven't seen before. What does this next generation of leaders that are going to succeed what skills do they have? You're a recruiter. You're looking at skills profiles and matrices. All it sounded like I said matrices, like multiple matrix. And maybe you are hiring for matrices, but what is that skills matrix of this next gen leader? Because I don't think it's been solidified, and I do think it's going to flip a few things that we've been advocating for the last several decades on its head.
Yeah. There's a couple things there. I sat down with a gentleman a couple weeks ago, and he was giving me some advice on the business, and he was like, strategy's cheap now. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And he's like, there used to be a time where companies would go out and they would hire this big consulting firm. They would spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars for this firm to do a whole bunch of research and tell them exactly what they needed to do. And he was like, tell me what you do and give me like a few bullet points. Told him, he plugged it into his phone. He was like, here's your strategy. I reviewed it. Of course, it was GPT or Perplexity, something like that. I reviewed it. It's almost the exact strategy we're using right now. So maybe it did some research, but it was like, start a podcast, build relationships, and then those relationships will naturally turn into a referral partner channel. And so if strategy's cheap, then what's not cheap or what still needs to happen? And that's the focusing of human energy inside of organizations and making like the, when you talk about what skills, it's the soft skills and it's the critical thinking. And I think that's actually on the critical thinking part, I think that's actually a big problem that we have right now. So not only do we have all this technology and everything else, but I think people are thinking less critically because information is just being fed to them so quickly. And these are coming from places of influence that they trust or believe for whatever reason. And we're not thinking critically anymore. We're just believing the first thing that hits our face. So I think that's a very dangerous place to be. But the short-winded answer is I think soft skills, empathy, understanding, and being able to manage that human energy to be able to execute on the strategies. And then the second part, potentially the bigger problem we're going to have in the next generation is thinking critically.
That I've heard the EQ, excuse me, soft skills type thing from a number of people. And I would agree, like our humanity actually increases in value the less that we have to act like robots, where we're just like that cat in the GIF, like I'm just typing away data entry. Yay. But the notion of thinking critically, I've seen that show up. Because I'm a nerd and I'm not shy about my nerddom, I've had some friends, some fellow entrepreneurs see what I'm doing with AI and different platforms. They're like, hey, how could I do a little bit of that for myself? And I'm like, here, let me show you. We could get started here. What are you working on right now? So they get a fast use case because that helps with adoption. But one of the things that I'm noticing is the patterns of thought and analysis on what they're doing and how they're doing it are still like last gen. And I'm not saying that as an insult to them because this is a widespread issue that I'm hearing about, but I've gotten to see it up close over the last few months. Is whether you're using one of the AI platforms, GPT, Claude, Gemini, Grok, as a glorified Google search, like you're way missing the boat. Just go back to Google search and get a little sprinkling. It's like a little salt bay of AI in the mix on your results page. But it is the one, I have to know my shit so much that I can call out the AI or the technology when it misses something. I have to know the human side of the process, the facts of the information. Because it's got to be, I love what you said about an exoskeleton, right? The exoskeleton is totally useless without the person like inside the little mechanism moving. Then it makes you fast and strong and you can make a cool movie out of it. But I'm thinking of the Matrix. But if you don't have that part intact, if you can't think critically about the information you're being given, then you're just amplifying garbage. As a matter of fact, I even put that in one of my weekly newsletters a couple of weeks ago because there's this big like viral post on X. I think it's probably over 85 to 90 million views at this point about how seriously AI is going to impact work and culture and just society in general. And I said, you can use AI, but it's only an amplifier.
Yes.
And so if your work is garbage, you're going to amplify garbage. If it's good, it's going to become great. I equate that. I use that, the amplifier, magnifier, when I talk to people about marriage, like kids. I used to work in youth ministry and different things. I was like, you will never fix anyone by marrying them. Whatever and whatever is bad will become terrible, god-awful, but whatever's good is going to become amazing. And I think AI does a similar thing with it. So in thinking critically, do you think thinking critically has the same definition but an elevated importance? Or do you think it has and is taking on a new meaning for people with the way that we're moving?
I don't know if it's like a different, like, I think thinking critically has always been important. So I went to Naval War College a couple years ago, and I think the biggest education that I got from that experience was more so like thinking critically and questioning everything, not necessarily the wars that we studied or anything else. It's like how to think in the framework in which to think. That said, I think it's going to become critically important, because what I'm seeing is your and I's era, we probably had Encyclopedia Britannica?
Britannica? Yeah. Britannica? Yeah.
There it was. Yeah. And then we were going through school and the internet came, and then we weren't allowed to use Wikipedia and all these other things. And so, like, there was a lot of evolution for us. However, the speed at which information is consumed, it has drastically increased. And so I think the importance of thinking critically and questioning everything. And I was actually having a conversation, so relevant, because I was having a conversation with my daughter last night. We're watching a news channel, and there's this guy on giving an assessment. And she was like, why should we trust him? I was like, great question, keep going. And she was like, what's his credentials? Like, what are his influences? What's his background? What are his beliefs? What are his worldviews? I was like, what great questions. Because it just showed me that she's starting to think through things of not like, I'm hearing this, therefore it's true, but really starting to go to the source of truth. And that's just a news channel. That's not AI. So, like, you start to think about how AI is going to become a part of everybody's daily lives, and it's just going to continue to feed us information. We have to continue to question. I was about to go dark with this, or else it's going to be Terminator. And we're all just, it's like the, what is it? It's like the averages, and it's just dumbing everybody down. I think that's a very real possibility.
Yeah, I totally agree. Also, kudos to you for raising a daughter that is already questioning things at that level. That's a huge win. If I had gold stars, I'd give you one. But I love that. And I try to teach my kids the same thing. Is it's essentially, I want to teach them how to think.
Yes.
I don't necessarily what to think. There are a few key, maybe moral issues or things like that where I really want to inform that. But otherwise, I want to teach them how to think. And it's a big reason why this podcast is named How Leaders Think, not What Leaders Do.
Yeah.
Because it's the mental models, the frameworks, the critical thinking, the reasoning, to use in, you know, what now is a very popular AI term. What is our reasoning? How are we reasoning? Can we reason together? Can we reason against an AI that passes all these benchmarks that make it PhD level at most everything it could talk about, but it could still miss it? Do we ascribe some sort of infallible halo to any of these platforms, which don't do? I forgot. I think it was the president said, trust but verify,
yep.
And, which I think is fine. And which sort of leads me into the question for you about how are you going to distinguish, whether it's for yourself, your daughter, the employees, team members, clients, how do we start to draw the lines between critical thinking and cynical thinking? Because I think a lot of people conflate the two, and I think that's where a lot of this polarization, especially in the West, especially in the US, polarization, it could be a political parties, ideologies, things like that, I think largely come from, we get into our tribal mind and we become skeptical instead of critical, because critical would allow us to have discourse and debate and reason together. How do we keep ourselves from floating into that skeptical pool, which I don't think anybody ever says, oh yes, I'm very skeptical and that's the best way to live. I think even people who brag about it would deep down inside, they go, yeah, this is probably not the best way, but it's the only way I know. And I don't have time to give them therapy.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's, That's a big question. Here's my philosophy and how I've been probably living my own life for maybe the last 10 to 15 years, which is it's curiosity. Like how I think about things. It's not about skepticism or and it is about critical thinking. It backs into critical thinking, but like it's both of them together, where it's be skeptical of everything and at the same time like think through like what needs to be true or what could be false about this. But for me, it's about this sense of constant curiosity and just wanting to learn and explore and to a certain extent, like that's how I operate in business as well. Like just this intense curiosity to like get out of my own biases. And we're like, nobody's perfect. And for me, like I'll say things or make statements or make decisions or something else. And then I'll go back and reflect on it and be like, oh my gosh, like that was a bad decision or a terrible action or whatever the case may be. And then I'll go through and be like, how did I come to that conclusion? And it's something, it's my worldview, it's the influences. And so it's a constant work in progress, but just an acknowledgement to always be curious.
I like that. ABC, always be curious. You can be closing as well, and you get some coffee with that course of action, because that's only for closers. But, and that's why I drink coffee. A little brag on myself. But I love that. And I've had curiosity or some form of that as a core value of mine in business or personally for probably the last like 10, 11 years. As I started to think through, how do I keep peeling through things and learning and getting the nuance and things that were, again, you get to reflect and what are people telling you outside of yourself and what do you think of yourself and how do you see yourself can all be big things. I hate saying close the loop, circle back, and any of that other jargon bullshit that makes me want to sit in a tub full of scissors. But to come back to product market, service market fit, and curiosity and critical thinking, how do those two relate to each other? And I'm trying not to ask it as, here's a softball question, Ryan. Because you talked about having a hypothesis going to market, but I do think that there are some cases, and I generally have come to dislike when people pull in like Steve Jobs, Apple, Elon, like basically exceptions to a lot of things, because I don't think they're great measurement tools, because you're just going to come up short, and also you got to run your own race. But something I think Jobs was very good at and was documented and talked about was he had a talent for knowing what product the market wanted or even needed before they knew. Because if you had gone and pulled people on things they wanted from their phone, they would not have come up with the iPhone. I think, what was it, Henry Ford that said, if I had given people what they wanted faster horses or more. But instead, he like innovated and had a car. So how does curiosity play a role when you're a visionary, right? Whether that's EOS language or just generally you think of yourself that way as a founder or leader, how do you balance that visionary tendency to maybe see further, faster, maybe see where the market's heading, but also not be so ahead or so abstract that you can't sell anything? Because you can have the most wonderful idea in the world, but if you don't sell anything, you're just a dude or a gal with an idea that's probably avoided at coffee shops.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think like some of the names, the Henry Fords, the Elons, I don't know, maybe we throw Bezos into that, but definitely Steve Jobs. There's actually probably Jeff Bezos was more along the lines of saw an opportunity and just continued to crank at it. But you're right with Steve Jobs and Henry Ford, where it's if they would have pulled the market would have told them something very different. I think that there's like this experience and innate sense that comes with all of this. And so like your hypothesis is going to be stronger based upon the experiences that you've had leading to that. So for instance, like when I think about Talent Harbor and the business model that we launched with, that was a pain point that I already had before this. So like I knew that there was going to be some semblance of like loose product market fit going into it. And it was just keeping that open mind to be able to like pivot and iterate our way to the success. But I don't know, like it's It's tough. It is the absolute hardest thing to do in business is find product market fit. And that's, it's just about being unafraid to fail and moving as fast as possible, listening to the signals and iterating until you find it.
Right. I do think that there's another ditch you can fall into, which is you may be really good at reading the market and giving it what it wants, but you're totally transactional. Like you have no belief in it. You're just because the market wants it doesn't make it a good thing. And doesn't make it a helpful thing, like what they think they want. That's why, like when we go into the doctor, you should be listening to what they said. Like they went to years of medical school to understand things. And instead, we're just like, just give me the strongest narcotic you got. Or we're the it's a joke, but I think it's appropriate, is the sort of the guy who's sitting on the table and he's, I think that I have so many broken things. Like I think my jaw's broken, my knee's broken, my arm is broken. And the doctor takes a look at him and says, all those seem good, but I do think your finger's broken.
Yeah.
So, and that's where I think having the curiosity, but also the resilience of failure to not just give the market what it wants, but something that genuinely improves and solves for something in a way that leaves the person better, not just got them to spend their money.
And go ahead.
Go ahead.
You were bringing up a point too that I think is critical. And I was reflecting on it as you said it. You talked a little bit about this passion or this idea of you have to believe in the thing that you're doing. And it's so interesting you bring that up because, you know, what I've fallen back on, whether it was Run for Your Lives or Hunt to Killer or now Talent Harbor, is I didn't really care about zombies. I only played one out of the hundreds of Hunt to Killer games. I only played one, and that's because we had a board meeting where we brought our families and we all played together virtually during the pandemic. And I'm not really keen on recruiting. Like I'm not necessarily passionate about recruiting. However, my old talk track was this idea of I like bringing brilliant people together to solve hard problems. And one of the things that I just reflected on as you were talking was the hard problem is actually movements. And it's like changing an entire industry. So when I think about Hunt to Killer, like the game industry has been around, Clue's been around, it's been around forever, but nothing had ever been done where it like truly makes you a detective. With Talent Harbor, like, apologies to all the recovering recruiters out there, but the recruiting industry is nasty. It is dirty. It is untrustworthy. Yep. It's very similar to the used car salesman. And no offense to used car salesman, but at the end, but it's like the reason that CarMax existed is because there was a lack of trust and transparency in the used car buying process. And then CarMax came out. And they changed an entire industry. And that's what we look at Talent Harbor. Like if you go to our website, it's like world-class sales recruiters. Great. That's not really what we're like. That gets our foot in the door so that we can have the real conversation of we're changing the entire industry because we're bringing trust and transparency back into this business service category.
Gotcha. That recruiting is your output, but that transformation of trust in the recruiting industry is your outcome.
Yep. Oh, that's good. I'm going to re-listen to this podcast now. That was really good.
There you go. Clip that. Yeah. And I've tried to think of like, how do you separate inputs, outputs, and outcomes? And I think that can be really hard. You could get into the messaging and branding of things of they have an external need and then there's an internal one and then there's a philosophical pain point that you was like, it shouldn't be this hard to buy a used car. I don't know why people talk like that still, but they do. I turned into the announcer from The Price is Right, a new car, but, and not the Drew Carey version. Sorry, Drew, but I think that's hard for people to separate, but I do think it's important. And one thing that, as you were discussing and describing that came to mind is Clayton Christensen's book, Competing Against Luck and the Jobs to Be Done framework. Is why are, like, there's a pretty, I say famous, it was one of the more frequently cited studies from his work that he did with McDonald's around their shake. Is what are people hiring it for, hiring the shake to do, and what is it actually competing against? And it wasn't competing against health food or anything else. People were hiring the shake because they could, it would last the whole trip. If you're commuting an hour or so, you could sip on that. If you eat an apple, you're done in 20 seconds. A candy bar, you feel guilty for popping a Snickers at 7:30 in the morning. You might feel like you have a problem and you need to go to a program. But a shake, it was like, okay, it's not totally bad for me, and it'll last a long time. And then it left them full later in the day, because other solutions, they got hungry by 9:30, but a shake could keep you full until lunchtime.
Yep.
And so when they started figuring those things out, like, the output was a shake. McDonald's needed to sell more shakes, and they discovered that the weakness was in the morning time. Why aren't we selling it more? And then they did the research and figured out, these are the outcomes people want. Our output is a shake. Nothing's wrong with the output. We just aren't speaking to the outcome people really want and the job that they want to hire it for. And I think that's a large part of product market, service market, whatever the fit is that you're trying to, and those are largely the two things that you're looking at. I think those are what you go to market asking. I think it does this one thing, but it ends up doing another. And there's dozens and dozens of stories of people invented one thing. It got used, like an off-label use of it. Yep. And that ended up being what took it off, was a weird one-off case that it was used on. But I think some of that comes back to the curiosity you were discussing, is not being precious about, no, it can only be used in this manner, in this scenario, by these people.
Yep. And I've been, like, one comment on that. I've been wrong 100% of the time about the hypothesis of the product market fit. So I'll give you a for instance, like, half the battle here, when we say product, the other half of this is market. And so both of those have to be true. So you have to develop a product for a specific market. And I follow the lean startup principles. And so for me, it's once you have the idea, like, you take that idea to as many markets as possible to see if there's some sort of need for that solution. And then and only then do you start modifying the product, because it takes a lot of effort to modify the product versus, like, just attacking another market. But I've been wrong 100% of the time. So for instance, and even the outcomes, I'll give you an example with Hunt to Killer. Like, I thought this was going to be college people that wanted to play games in their dorm rooms. It wasn't. And maybe with a little bit more thinking, I should have known this, but it was 45 to 60 year old women. That was our primary target. And we're talking like $205 million worth of games sold over a 6 year process or 6 year stint.
Wow.
And that was the primary market for that. And then to your point about the outcomes, what we thought is people wanted to be detectives. I think that was the draw. Like, the draw of this was I want to be a detective. There's these communities that were starting all over the place because of the podcast movement, My Favorite Murder, Sword and Scale. And that was the hypothesis. But what really happened is it created deeper and more meaningful connections amongst the people that our players or our detectives wanted to. Meaning that, yes, they were playing a game, but they were playing that game with their children. They were playing that game with their partner. They were playing that game at wine night. And so, like, the outcome of that was completely different than what we had ever imagined.
Wow. That's crazy. I think, sadly, Hunt a Killer, their demographic, I think, has been taken over by Mahjong. I don't know what's going on and why that is sweeping the nation with women. Like, I go to Panera every day, and there's people, they got, like, custom cloths and everything. I was like, when did this ancient Chinese game take over the American female game playing industry? I don't know. It's baffling to me. I don't understand the fit. But clearly, I'm not the target market, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I think this really helpful. I think there's probably like a dozen more things that I would love to dig into, and we'll have to have you back to discuss those things. But if somebody was listening to this and they're like, okay, I think I get it. Maybe they're an entrepreneur, or maybe they're an intrapreneur. Maybe they're someone that's working in a department and they're trying to help their side of things take off and move. If somebody wanted to take a baby step, spending little to no money in the next 24 hours to become better at discovering the product market fit or service market fit, what would you tell them to do, or what resources would you point them towards?
Yeah, and we actually just did this internally, and it was one of the most powerful exercises that we've ever done. And it's just going to be so simple, and people are going to be like, oh, okay, of course, dummies. We talked to our clients, and we asked them questions. And like the lessons that like literally were like, hey, where do you find the most value in this? What's the problem that we were solving for, that we are solving for? And then one of two things, either we went in and we said, if there was another offering, or what's one thing if you were CEO of Talent Harbor, like what would you do different or what would you add? Or we A/B tested this, or we seeded our own idea to them just to get their feedback based upon that. And we've put these things together to iterate our model, which we'll be launching here in the next few weeks. Anyhow, but that, like, the short answer here is like, the easiest step that you can make is literally call your clients. And if you don't have clients yet, let's say this is an entrepreneur, an intrapreneur that has an idea and they're trying to get off the ground, then go call whoever you think your clients are. Because for some reason, like, calling and having conversations is becoming a lost art. Back to our AI conversation. And so I think someone wants to make significant progress over the next 24 hours, get on the phone with your clients or prospective clients and see what problems they're having inside of their business that you may be able to help with.
I really like that. There was somewhat of an avid follower of all things Alex Hormozi. I like a lot of his content. Plus, I think some of his stuff is really funny. But on his email, I think it was this week, he was talking about that as reaching out and asking questions. And they were really good. As if we were going to like strip things out of the product that you have now or your plan, what's the one feature you would fight for to keep? And then what is the, and then the flip side of like, what's the one thing that if we took it away, you would just shrug and be like, no big deal. I thought those were, again, I think most of business and even leadership and things in life, they aren't complex. They're simple, but they're really hard to do well. And I think that's where practice and craft and resiliency come in. But I love that idea of just pick up the phone, start calling people. Phones don't look like this anymore, but this looks weird because now it looks like is this a bag phone? Is this probably like a telecom thing in one of your helicopters. Is hello? But Ryan, this has been a lot of fun. And I think listeners have gotten a lot out of this, but if they wanted to know more about you, more about Talent Harbor, or maybe just have some follow-up questions of their own, where can they connect with you, find you, and learn more?
Yeah, LinkedIn would be LinkedIn's best. And by the way, I love like brainstorming this stuff. So if someone's listening to this and they're just like, hey, I have this idea and I need to bounce it off somebody, I love having those conversations. And so just find me on LinkedIn. It's I think / Ryan E. Hogan, but just look for Ryan Hogan and it's got a weird mustache in the profile photo. You can't miss it.
Can't miss it. And we'll make sure that that's linked up. We'll also include your YouTube channel. And then talk just a little bit about your podcast, because I'd love for people to go and check that out if that's something they're looking for.
Yeah, two things changed my life. Number one, Vistage. And so my first company bankrupted. We talked a little bit about the Run for Your Lives, and it grew very, very quick. We scaled it nationwide, and then we busted it just as fast. And so I said, if I ever am lucky enough to find product market fit again, I'm going to find a group of people that have been there, done that, that can help me out. And so when Hunt to Killer started to take off, I joined Vistage, and through Vistage, I learned about EOS. And so the two things that have changed my life, Vistage, EOS. I've got a podcast. Actually, I've got two now. That's a whole nother thing. But I've got a podcast called Confessions of an Implementer. And the whole idea is we bring on EOS implementers and have conversations about the background, their backgrounds, their journey, and then also like the things that they're seeing inside of the businesses that they're helping. And there's so many nuggets there. And then the other podcast that just launched is called Confessions of a Vistage Chair. And so we bring on Vistage Chairs and have great conversations with them. But yeah, check them out if you want to learn more.
Awesome. And we will definitely link to those on Apple Podcasts, but I'm sure it's available wherever fine podcasts are sold, listened to, I don't know, consumed. What's the right word? We should probably figure that out, or I should at least. But Ryan, this was a lot of fun. I hope to have you back in the future, and maybe we'll talk about Mater D's on that one. That's that and our favorite types of wind. But listeners, thank you so much. You spent some time with me and Ryan, and we know that you have many choices when it comes to podcast listening, or you could listen to music, or you could listen to the Joe Rogan Experience, which is taking on a mind of its own. But you listen to us, and we're really, really grateful. If you would, do me a favor, like, rate, review, subscribe, whatever the button of action is on your platform of choice. I would be really grateful for that because it gets more conversations like these in front of other people who need it, who are looking for it just like you. And it's a free and easy way for you to pay it forward. And won't that make you feel warm and fuzzy? And I think that's all we ever want really in this world is the warm and fuzzies. But until next time, change the way you think, you'll change the way you lead. We'll see.